The Rio Grande, also called the Rio Grande, is one of the longest rivers in North America and one of the most endangered. Welcome to Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. I'm Salwa Khan. The Rio Grande's headwaters are in the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, and it flows for approximately 1,900 miles, crossing the U.S. states of New Mexico and Texas, and then into Mexico and eventually to the Gulf of Mexico. In New Mexico, the river bisects the state, running north to south, and most of the mountains in New Mexico drain into the Rio Grande. Over the last 100 years, the river's flow has shrunk, and that is bad news for all the people who depend on it, for farming, industry, household water use, and recreation. The World Wildlife Fund is committed to protecting and restoring the river, and as part of that effort, is partnering with an organization in New Mexico called Rio Grande Return. Rio Grande Return is implementing a project to restore the land that edges the river, also called riparian areas, to a more natural and healthier state than currently exists. Doing so increases the water-holding capacity of the river, among other things. Reed Whittlesey, Rio Grande Return's restoration director, has grave concerns about the current state of the Rio Grande.
We are looking at a very affected river that is has diminished over, you know, the decades and centuries that we've been impacting it, and current climate futures do not necessarily bode well for the continued flow in the way that it has in the past. And so I think, yeah, it is there are elements that are thriving and there are elements that very much are not.
Can you talk about why the water flow is shrinking? What are the factors involved?
There is, you know, a degree of agricultural usage up in the San Luis Valley, kind of throughout the length of the river. It has for centuries been used as an agricultural hub. I think the greater story that I am more involved in is kind of the degradation of all of the contributing watersheds and kind of the lack of water storage on the landscape as a whole, which is contributing to flashier flows and a more abrupt hydrograph that does not see it flowing as steadily as it once did. And on top of that, we are in a period of drought in the Southwest that is being compounded by the impacts of climate change.
So it's fair to say that there's a scarcity of water from the river. Who does that impact?
Scarcity of water in the Southwest has been a consistent factor in the human populations here over time. And the argument that it affects all of us, from residents to big commercial farms to small-scale agriculture, is a very real argument to make. I live along a tributary of the Rio Grande in a small community, and it's a traditional agricultural community, but as stream flow decreases, our acequia system, which is it's a very old historic ditch irrigation system, is losing water because it you can irrigate when there's enough water in the stream to divert some flow for agricultural fields. But if that flow is not sufficient, then you can't divert that. And so some of my neighbors have not had their acequias run more, since, June or so. So just for a small scale impact. I think, larger scale, it's yeah, there kind of becomes a tip towards using groundwater, and that is also quite complicated. But yeah, I think, water scarcity in the Southwest is a pretty existential issue for all of the populations here.
Let's talk about your organization, the Rio Grande Return. What is its mission and purpose? And is all your work based in New Mexico?
Yeah, Rio Grande Return is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we work to restore the riverscapes and ecosystems unique to the arid Southwest using low-tech and process-based methods to foster resilience, adaptive capacity, and stewardship in these important land and water resources. We're very much a hands-on organization with a big focus on getting the work done on the ground. And so we have several field crews that are very much focused on project implementation.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan here with Reed Whittlesey, Rio Grande Return's Restoration Director. So Rio Grande Return works with the World Wildlife Fund on protecting and restoring the river. How did that partnership begin, and what is your organization doing toward that goal?
We began working with the World Wildlife Fund several years ago when they released a request for proposal, which they had some funding to allocate towards restoration work. They sent out this RFP, as they're known, and we applied and were successful in receiving the grant funding to implement a beaver habitat restoration project in the Jemez Mountains of New Mexico along the Rio Saboya. And so we've been working with them for the last 2 years on that project.
Yeah, and so one of your projects, as I understand it, is called the Riverscape Restoration Program. Can you give us an outline of it, and then let's go into some different aspects of it in more depth?
Riverscape, we used to refer to more as just a riparian area or like a wetland or something. And Riverscapes acknowledges that it is the river itself is tied to all of the other pieces of the landscape, and having gaps in that ecology will impact the health of the river itself. And so our program is trying to find where those gaps are missing, and through an ecologically based approach, kind of give nature the ingredients that it needs to, or the tools that it needs to kind of fill those gaps itself. So we're not going into a river system and engineering new channel dimensions, and then or determining that it should be this, and then taking a bulldozer in and or a big excavator and creating this channel. We are working with the kind of pre-existing ecological processes to affect the trajectory that the system has already, and trying to kind of facilitate that shift towards a more functional and intact state.
So you're working with nature rather than against it.
Very much so. Yeah, we are very much trying to take as much of the cutting edge peer-reviewed science that is supporting restoration practices and learn how to apply that on the landscape.
And then one of the projects is building beaver dams. So talk about that, and how does that contribute to the health of the river and streams?
Yeah, we build a lot of beaver dam analogs, which are basically fake beaver dams. We do the best job that we can to build them like a beaver would. Beavers are a lot better at it than humans, but we're learning and getting better ourselves. But a big focus of ours is identifying areas that historically were occupied by beaver that have not had beaver present or have beaver present at a much lower abundance than the historical level. And through restoration, create the condition for either reoccupation or population expansion. And beaver dam analogs are a really important piece in that specifically, but also have very broad-reaching ecological benefits above and beyond strictly providing habitat for beaver, such as increasing water storage capacity, water filtration, i.e., increasing water quality, flood attenuation, increasing fire resiliency, functional riparian area can a healthy area, riparian area can actually work as a fire break, at the very least as a refugia for wildlife during a wildfire. So they're really these broad-reaching impacts of the restoration treatments.
In addition to the beaver dams, you're putting whole tree trunks and branches into streams. Why is that?
One of the pieces is that through a long period of kind of extractive use on our headwater stream systems, going back in New Mexico into the 1700s, where we had really high levels of livestock browse, the streams have become what's termed structurally starved. So they're lacking in both beaver dams, which were historically very, very abundant. Every headwater system, more or less in North America, had had beaver dams, except for a small pocket in the Great Basin. And the large wood recruitment of old growth and healthy fire regimes was another really, really important piece in stream ecology. And so through kind of this long degradation of livestock browsing, fire suppression, logging, their eradication of beaver associated with the fur trade in the 1800s, there are kind of these, all of these impacts have stacked upon themselves to the point where a lot of our headwater streams now are very oversimplified. And so through the addition of the beaver dam analogs and the wood into the stream in the form of these post-assisted log structures or whole trees in some instances, we're kind of restarting that natural process of the wood recruitment and the impacts of the beaver dams. Adding wood into the into systems is stream systems is overall very beneficial. It is great habitat for fish. It's really important for a whole host of other aquatic species. But then the kind of hydrologic piece, which translates to kind of the ecosystem services benefit, is also really interesting, where during high flows, these structures will encourage the flow to access the floodplain, which once the stream flow is on the floodplain, the velocity really drops out.
Yes.
And a lot more water will then soak into that surface, which replenishes the groundwater table. And it also has a measurable impact on flood attenuation. And so, in an era where we're looking at these more high-intensity storm events that cause really severe flooding, one of the ways that we can start tackling that is through working to heal our headwater stream systems, which very much behave as these sponges on the landscape that can slow and hold the water as it falls as precipitation.
Right. This makes me think of, in permaculture, where you build berms and swales to control water flow and allow it to soak into the land.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, historically, before we went into these systems, indirectly through the livestock and livestock grazing and fire suppression and logging and road construction, all of that, they were all river ways in North America were these incredibly complex systems where getting a boat down them would have been a nightmare. And arguably, by many metrics, that is the healthiest possible state for our rivers. And now that we have occupied and kind of developed so much of the these areas that were floodplains or still are floodplains, we can't get back to that. And so what we're doing at Rio Grande do Turn is trying to find areas within the headwaters on primarily public land where we do have that capacity to create these really complex, messy riverscapes that are, as close to an undisturbed ecological condition as we can get in the modern era.
You mentioned livestock. What do livestock do that damages riparian areas?
There was a peer-reviewed paper out of New Mexico State University by Dr. Jennifer Fry that was looking at limitations to beaver habitat expansion in northern New Mexico specifically. And the findings were that livestock grazing poses the biggest issue towards that expansion. It's a very complicated issue where it's on these public lands, there is a multi-use mandate. Like grazing has been here. A lot of the families in New Mexico that have these public land grazing leases have been doing it for generations. I myself am not someone who is opposed to public land grazing, but having it done in a way that can allow for the riparian areas to kind of restore more of their pre-disturbance condition is something that it arguably is very important to kind of all of us water users along the Rio Grande.
Is part of the problem that humans have taken over many floodplains because we want to use the land along the waterway?
Floodplains are have been really extensively developed. I forget the exact percentage, but an enormous percentage of floodplains are developed nationwide. And the reason for that is that they're often flat or flatter than the surrounding landscape, and they have really much richer soils. But they were created by rivers flooding. And as kind of we as a species have kind of blindly moved into these spaces, we need to kind of retain that cognizance. And what beavers do, especially on kind of smaller streams, is reactivate that floodplain. Like their dam building activity will kind of remove the water from this confined single-threaded channel and spread it out across the floodplain, where it becomes this anabranching, like multi-threaded, braided system. But now we have roads on these floodplains. We have houses or agricultural fields. And especially in northern New Mexico, a lot of these floodplains are where we have the acequia, like ditch irrigation and small scale agriculture. And so when beavers move back into those, it creates a direct conflict where the beaver will try to dam the acequias, the ditches, or will build a dam in the stream channel and then flood out someone's field. And so there is a lot of like direct conflict by between beavers and human uses. And I hope that kind of through various means of policy and working with agencies and landowner outreach and education and developing better coexistence practices, that those impacts can be mitigated and that we can increase our ability to coexist with those critters.
Why are humans having to build beaver dams? Aren't there enough beavers to build natural beaver dams?
That piece of the story is really important, and it actually goes back to hat styles in Europe in the early 1800s, which is kind of ridiculous. And yeah, there was, a fad for beaver pelt hats that drove nearly to the extermination of beavers across North America in, the early 1800s. And yeah, it's kind of absurd to think that one of our continent's most important ecosystem engineers, very much a keystone species, was absolutely decimated due to hat preferences in Europe.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan. I'm here with Reed Whittlesey. He's Rio Grande Return's Restoration Director. And then, how do invasive plant species affect the river's flow?
Invasive species such as tamarisk, also known as salt cedar, Russian olive, and Siberian elm, are very common at lower elevations, in along the Rio Grande, kind of sub. You'll be getting into some Siberian elm around 8,500 or so, but along the vast majority of the Rio Grande in New Mexico, it is absolutely choked with those three species. Russian olive is particularly nasty because it has these really long thorns. But they all use a lot of water, and especially Siberian elm. I've cut one down. I've cut many down doing invasive removal projects, but one in particular comes to mind where I did a face cut with a chainsaw, and it immediately started just flowing with sap to the point where I could have filled up a Nalgene water bottle in a couple minutes. And that illustrated to me just how much evapotranspiration that the tree was contributing to. All vegetation contributes to evapotranspiration. So there always is some degree of water loss in having plant species exist along waterways.
And then you're replanting with native trees like willow and cottonwood.
We plant a lot of willow and cottonwood, both at kind of these lower elevation sites where we've done invasive removal, but we also plant a lot of them up on these headwater projects where the willow, particularly the willow component, has been reduced over time due to this long legacy of livestock. And actually, now elk have a similar impact where they prefer eating willow and will target it to the point where it is extirpated, locally extirpated from the landscape along a lot of our stream systems. And so then that creates a condition where beaver are no longer able to move back in because they don't have the material for dam building.
And what results are you getting?
Through our monitoring, it's really neat to kind of see some of the very, quantifiable data-driven results. We're also seeing an increase in the water table, which is what the beaver dam analogs and large wood structures really contribute to, meaning that we're starting to get that floodplain connectivity, which is kind of the end goal for a lot of the projects. It's kind of more like being able to see kingfishers, where I'd never seen kingfishers for, a decade, and all of a sudden they're there every week that I'm out at the site, or osprey are coming back. There are families of ducks occupying the project reach, whereas in the past I would never see ducks. At one of these sites, which was very much intended to be a beaver habitat restoration site, we would occasionally see beaver sign moving through the area, but they were never directly occupying it. And this last year, it became clear that there was not only one, but two family units of beavers that had set up lodges within the project reach. And so to me, that really showed, we have succeeded. The goal is to create beaver habitat. Beavers moved in.
Do you think in general people should be concerned about the availability of water?
I think nationwide, there are going to be issues surrounding water as our climate becomes more and more volatile. In New Mexico, specifically, there was a USGS climate report that was published 2 years ago that is predicting through, the running of many, many models, that we will see a 25% reduction in surface flow along the Rio Grande, which is quite significant considering that it already goes dry in Albuquerque nearly every year. And some of the streams that I've been working on and have active projects on recently have always been perennial streams, yet are increasingly becoming intermittent, meaning that they're starting to not flow consistently throughout the year. They are beginning to dry up. That trajectory is frightening. And we have the tools to mitigate a lot of those impacts. We have a good foot in science to support those tools. It's more an issue of applying them at the right scale and prioritizing them. Everyone should be, if not concerned, then very much aware of where their water comes from, what that future looks like, and how their watershed is being managed.
That's all for now. This has been Mothering Earth on restoring the flow of the Rio Grande River. Thanks to our guest, Reed Whittlesey of Rio Grande Return, and to the World Wildlife Fund. And thanks so much to you for listening. Until next time, this is Salwa Khan signing off for Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. The views and opinions expressed on Mothering Earth do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of this station.